the discussion of renormalization of FIFO theory at one loop, and I hope to finish it and start to discuss aspects of renormalization group in the framework of perturbation theory. So remember what we did last time. We saw that in dipole 4, the FIFO theory has ultraviolet divergence, but we want to express the theory in terms of physical quantity. So we start from an action that contains all the possible terms for the FIFO theory, but we do not determine yet at the beginning of the construction what are the coefficients of the action. So we start from what you call the renormalized action. Which is in an Euclidean setting, but S of phi equal integral in four dimension, and I have a factor A in front of the kinetic term, a factor B in front of the cubic of the quartic term, and a factor C in front of the quartic term. Okay, and I compute my correlation function using this action, or if you want this corresponding Hamiltonian in the canonical formalism. Okay. And we are interested in constructing a theory that is massless, which means that the physical mass of the particle is zero. That's as a first step, but that's important to understand this step. Okay, and so we have seen that if we compute with such a renormalization, the two-point function of the theory in momentum space, which is a priori A times P squared plus B, this is the mass term, plus H bar C over 2 times a function that is a function of B and of lambda, where this function T of lambda is simply the integral of the tadpole graph with the corresponding propagator of the theory, which is now AK squared plus B. We have seen that this is a tadpole diagram, amplitudes of the tadpole diagram, and it contains a ultraviolet singularity. So if we use a cutoff by integrating over momenta that are smaller than this regulator, this is an ultraviolet regulator, then this behaves like lambda squared. Okay. But we have seen also that if we want a massless theory, this means that we want that the irreducible two-point function vanishes equal 0 at p squared equal minus the mass of the physical sphere equal 0. And this requires that, in fact, the bare mass term, if you want, in the action must not be 0, but it has to be fine-tuned so that it is this term that is equal to 0. Okay. Of course, this is up to terms of order h bar squared or c squared, we have seen. Okay. And we have seen that this massless condition implies that the fact that the physical mass implies that we must have A plus B times, no, I'm sorry, B plus h bar c over 2 times b t of b and of lambda equals 0. But this means that B is 0 plus a term over the h bar, so this can be replaced by B plus h bar c over 2 t of 0 and of lambda equals 0. Up to O of h bar term, we can take this condition for the counter terms. Okay? And in this case, this function t of b and of, and also, and we can take, so we can take this, and we can take a equal 1, because there is no contribution proportional to p squared in this order term, so no p squared dependence. So the residue of the pole at p squared equals 0 is not changed, you see. So we can take a equal 1 in this renormalization, but b has to be different from 0. Okay? And now if you compute this, this is t of b and of lambda, if we compute t of 0 and of lambda, this is just a very simple integral because this is an integral of a homogeneous term. So we can use a radial. We can disentangle the radial degrees of freedom and the angular degrees of freedom. And you end up with 1 over 4 pi squared times lambda squared. And that's it. That's to be proportional to lambda squared. Okay. So, of course, this depends on A. So let us call it T of lambda. It depends on A and B. Okay. And so, B is equal to 0, that's plus h bar c over 2 times 1 over 4 pi squared, minus, because this has to be equal to 0, lambda squared. And this is what is called the mass counter term. Okay, and you see that when you have this mass counter terms, the renormalized two-point function is just p squared. It's q squared plus nothing at order h bar plus term of order h bar squared. Okay, so it's perfectly fine. Okay, so now, what about the four-point function? And what about the coupling constant of the series? Okay. Well, we have seen that the irreducible four-point function, which is a function of p1 up to p4, so it's an object like that, with incoming momenta p1, 2, 3, 4, subject to the constraint that the sum of the pi from 1 to 4 is equal to 0. It is given by the vertex operator, the vertex term, and then, which is, and then there is at order h bar with a factor 1/2, this diagram plus the corresponding three diagrams that are obtained by permutation of the external legs. Yes? That's because it's a misprint. I woke up early this morning, so I'm a bit tired already. Okay, so that's gamma 4. Thank you. And that's with a hat. Okay. So, this is just, with annotation, the coupling constant of the theory, so it's C. And here you get, in fact, there is a minus sign. So that's a C squared, 1/2, a factor H bar, if you want to keep the factor H bar. And then you get the function that represents the amplitude of this diagram. So let's call it B, which is a function of the P1 plus P2, the momenta that comes between P1 and P2. It's a function of lambda. And then you have the same function for P1 plus P3, lambda, plus B of P1 plus P4, lambda. Okay? And this function B, it represents the amplitude, the Feynman amplitude associated to this bubble diagram obtained by, you have two propagators with an incoming momentum P. So this is given in the general theory by integral d4k over 2 pi to the power 4. Here I have an incoming momentum P. So here I have a momentum K, and here I have a momentum P plus K. So this will be A k squared plus B times 1 over A P plus K squared plus B in general. Okay, but we have seen that we are interested in terms of order H bar. So we can estimate this function only at leading order in H bar. And at leading order in H bar, A equal 1 and B is 0 plus term of order H bar. So we can set A to 1 and B to 0 in this equation. And we get, so this is equal d4k over 2 pi to the power 4, 1 over k squared, 1 over p plus k squared, plus term of order h bar, which is simpler. Okay? And this is, okay. So this function, the massless, bubble amplitudes still has an ultraviolet divergence. It still has divergent when lambda goes to infinity. If I integrate over the momenta that are basically less than lambda, but this integral occurs when you have large k. Then you have an integral over d4k over k to the power 4. So it's a so the large lambda divergence is independent on p because it occurs when k. So it's divergent when k is of order lambda and much larger than p. The external momenta. So the divergence is independent of the momentum P. And it's a logarithm. So this divergence must be proportional to a logarithm of lambda. Well, by the same kind of argument than here, you can set P equals 0 in this integral, integral over K at large K, and see how it diverges. And what you find is that you find the factor, well, again, this 1 over 4 pi squared times lambda squared. plus some finite term. Okay. And if you think a little bit more about this integral, this is a pure number. You see. So it has a function, it has to be proportional to log of something that is a pure number. And lambda has a dimension of a momentum or an energy. So it has to be divided by something that has a dimension of the momentum to make this number dimensionless. The only momentum we have at our disposal is the incoming momentum. So in fact, it is 1 over 4 pi. It can only be normalized so that it's 1 over 4 pi squared, lambda squared divided by p squared, plus eventually some constant that will depend a little bit over the regularization. Let us call it C plus term of order 1 over lambda squared, subdominant term. In fact, if you do the calculation, you realize that these are logs, in fact. So this comes just from a simple analysis of this divergence, and this constant requires a bit more work, but basically, let me rewrite this like that. Let me rewrite that this diagram here is b of p and of lambda, and it's 1 over 4 pi, it's b like 1 over 4 pi squared log of lambda squared over p squared, plus some constant c, that is not important, plus term, and trust me, they are over the log of lambda divided by lambda squared. Of course, it will be p squared over lambda squared and log of lambda divided by p squared. Okay, so these are subdominant terms that are finite, that goes to zero when lambda goes to infinity. Okay. And this coefficient here, it's a finite number. And it depends on the regularization chosen. If you take this sharp cutoff, or if you take the Poli-Villard regularization that I speak about, you get a different number. But it will turn out that, well, first it's finite, and second, this will disappear at the end of our calculation, the way we do the calculation. Okay. So this means that the four-point function contains a logarithmic divergence at one loop. Logarithmic divergence, ultraviolet divergence at one loop. Okay. But two remarks. You see that this, the log of L is independent on P, because the log P is finite for finite P. So in fact, this divergence is independent of P. I wrote it in a way that it, the log contains P, but the terms that lambda goes to infinity is independent of the momentum. So you get the idea that this log, you can recast it in the Kuplik constant. So the idea is, can we recast this divergence in the Kuplik constant C? Okay? So in order to do this, you have to think about it of what is the coupling constant? How do you measure the coupling constant? Or if you want, how do you measure the strength of some interaction between particles? Well, I'm a theoretician, so I almost never did any experiment. But in energy physics or in particle physics, you do scattering. You have particles that, you know, they have a short-range interaction when they collide. And to measure the strength of this short-range interaction, you do scattering experiments. So you do scattering experiments. You send two particles, they collide. Well, you look at the channel where two particles come out, and you have a differential cross-section. Okay, that may depend on the angle, but basically, the strength of the interaction will be proportional to the cross-section. If the cross-section is big, strong interaction. If the cross-section is small, little, the interaction is small, is weak, okay? And this differential cross-section are related to, you have seen in QFT1, I think, or get a glimpse of that, differential cross-section are related to S matrix element. Okay? So this is, so there is an S matrix with in and out states, and it tells you what's the probability amplitude to go from some in state to out state. And we have seen through something called the LSZ reduction formula. That this S matrix element can be somehow computed using Feynman diagrams. And basically, they are related to the connected, so-called the connected amputated Green function. You take some connected Green function corresponding to this corresponding S matrix element. You put on shell, so you remove the propagator and you compute on shell elements. Namely, you consider that the momenta lies on the mass shell, so satisfy the condition P squared plus M squared equals zero. And you remove the propagator here and here and here because it has a pole, and you keep what's remaining. Okay. And this object in our theory is basically the four-point function. So for instance, if I make a scattering two particles, so for instance, two particles by two particles, then basically my differential cross-section or the strength of my interaction will be related to the value of the connected, of the irreducible four-point function for a particular choice of external momenta, which correspond to my experiments, the energy at which I'm sending particles and measuring particles. Okay, it depends on the experiment. It depends on my choice of experiment. Okay, so I'm going to see in this calculation what this radiative correction means for the value of the four-point function at a given choice of the momenta. Okay, and I'm going to choose a particular set momenta, and will define what I call the renormal, the coupling constant, the physical coupling constant of that. So by simplicity, I will not choose momenta that correspond that are on the mass shell. It can be done, but it's a bit more complicated. I'm going to simplicity. I'm going to choose Euclidean momenta. It's a technical point. And I'm going to choose a technical momenta such that this momentum, and this momentum have the same modulus. So I choose some reference momenta. Let me call them, how can I call them? How did I call them in a consistent way? Yes, Puf. So I choose a set of Pi reference. So I call this REF means reference. Well, let me call them PR, because this will mean both reference and renormalization. Okay? And I choose this PI such that the modulus of P1 plus P2 reference equals the modulus of P1 plus P3 reference equals the modulus of P1 plus P4 reference. And I have to choose something for zeros. A natural choice would be to take this momenta to be equal to zero. But that's problematic because we are dealing with a massless theory. The particles are massless, so it corresponds to the on-shell condition. But you see that since these amplitudes have a log of lambda squared over p squared, there is a divergence when p squared equals zero. So it's one of these examples of this infrared divergence we discussed a little bit yesterday. So p squared equals zero is not possible because of infrared singularities. So these are singularities. Those are features of the theory. That doesn't mean that the theory is sick and ill-defined. It's just that the irreducible function, as well as the S-matrix element, have some singularity as zero momenta. And you have to, and that's because you may excite as many particles as you want at zero energy because, okay. So you have to choose something else. So let us choose P squared equal mu squared, with mu is called a renormalization scheme. Momentum or energy scale. And it corresponds basically to the choice of energy at which I measure I do my experiments. I send particle with a given energy, and I see what's the differential cross section. Okay?
If you have a massive theory, then is it better to just work with P squared?
You can do both. In a massive theory, you can choose P squared equals zero because there will be no singularity. You are simply measuring the interaction of particles at rest, and they can be at rest because they are massive. You can choose P squared equal M squared, you can still choose some mu independent. For instance, if you want to measure, you don't know the mass of your particle, you want to measure it, then you have to choose, make an experiment at a given energy, and from that you extract the mass of the particle. Okay, but you have no choice. You must do this for massless particle.
And with massive, regardless of what you choose, you get the same result?
Pardon?
Regardless of what you choose, you get the same result.
Without what?
You should get the same result if you choose P squared equals zero.
You are going to see that you don't find the same result for a very deep and physical reason. So I choose that. So let me define. That's a definition. What I call the renormalized coupling constant constant gr simply by the value of the four-point function at those momenta. So I define g renormalized as the value of the four-point function at those pi reference. Okay? So that's a number that I extract either from a theoretical calculation or from some experiment. So I define this as a renormalized coupling constant, and I call this GR. Okay, with this choice of reference momenta, this is simply, from those results, C minus h bar C squared over 2 times 3 logarithm of lambda squared over mu squared plus my little constant ball C plus term of order, and in that case that will be term of order, let's say 1 over lambda squared. In fact, there will be term of order mu squared, lambda squared, log of lambda squared over mu squared, but that's not very important. Okay. Plus term of order h bar squared. And you see that what's important for your quantum theory is that this is finite. So we can re-express C as a function of GR. So if I'm doing this, I re-express C as a function of GR. I get C equal, well, I just have to invert this, so I get C equal GR plus h bar 3/2. And then C squared, but can I replace C squared by h bar by GR? So I get log on lambda squared over mu squared plus this constant C plus negligible term in the limit lambda goes to infinity. That's O of mu squared over lambda squared. I forget about the log. Okay, plus O of h bar. Okay, so this is the analog of this result. When I re-expressed my bare coupling constant, if you want, C corresponds to a bare coupling constant, the coupling constant which is in the Hamiltonian, I start to build my quantum theory. As a function of my renormalized coupling constant, there is a coupling constant counter term. The renormalized or physical coupling constant is not the coupling constant we put, but it is renormalized by physical effects, the same kind of effects. These diagrams reflect the fact that a particle, instead of just interacting point-wise, they interact, emit some virtual intermediate particles that interact again. And the effective interaction is the sum of this semi-classical process and this quantum process, plus higher order quantum process. Okay, so this is there is a renormalization of the coupling constant is exactly in the same way there was a renormalization of the mass. Okay, and now, but now the interesting thing is that if you re-express the general four-point function, now re-express the four-point irreducible function in terms of GR. So I take the four-point function of the theory defined by my renormalized action here. And I change C into, I re-express C as a function of GR. What do I get? I get that gamma 4 of the P I's is equal to GR. And then I get my minus h bar over 2. And I get this B minus one of those terms. So I get, instead of a log of lambda squared divided by p squared, I get a log of mu squared divided by p squared. And here it will be p1 plus p2 squared. Okay? While the constant disappears, that's, then I get the same thing for changing P2 into P3, plus the same things for P, changing P2 into P4. I have, of course, a GR squared, very important. So this is minus H bar GR squared divided by 2. And then term of order mu squared divided by lambda squared up to some logs. And then term of order h bar squared. So you see that. Yes?
Can I ask, in the, when there is the frame equation for C, how did you react to that from inverting the equation for GR?
I'm sorry, what? I didn't understand.
I'm asking, how did you invert the equation for GR so that you get the equation for C, which is framed over there?
I just write that C equal GR plus H bar something that C squared. See? And I replace C here by GR. Squared plus h bar squared that I can neglect because I'm interested. See? Okay. Good. Okay, so you see that this object, so the original object was a function of C, of the momenta, but it was a function of the bare coupling constant and of lambda. So let's just rewrite it in that way. This was a function of C and of lambda. You see? So this function, which was a function of C and of lambda, can be rewritten as a function of the same momenta, the renormalized coupling constant, GR, and it depends on mu. Okay, and let me call, well, that's the same number, but let me call this new function the renormalized four-point function. Okay? So this is the same object, but expressed now as a function of GR instead of as a function of C. And what you see is that this object has a finite ultraviolet limit when lambda goes to infinity, but when gr is considered as fixed. Which means that if lambda is very, very large, but you have built your theory so that this renormalized coupling constant defined at a given energy scale mu is finite, then the effect of having a cutoff are negligible. And you get a finite sensible. Okay? Is this clear? It's clear here just from this simple calculation. Okay? So that's basically the receipt we have to do to construct a renormalized coupling function. You have to choose where is written this C. Yes. You have to choose a renormalization scale, mu. It was not needed here, but you have to choose a renormalization scale mu, re-express your 4-point function and your 2-point function by assuming that the 4-point function has a physical mass that is equal to zero, and that the 4-point function has value gr at this particular energy scale. And then, if the theory is has this property, if lambda, if you take the cutoff and you take it to infinity, but adjusting C and B so that the 2-point and the 4-point function are finite, then the effect of at some particular point, then the 4-point function and the 2-point function are finite for all value of the momenta. Yes?
So this is a feature of only this theory that we can't do on-children normalization from like the massless.
I'm sorry, we have what?
Is it a general feature of massless theories that we can't do on-children normalization of the 4-point function?
I think so. Yeah, no, I think you have to be more careful. Yeah. For massless theory, you cannot do on-shell because you have infinite singularity on-shell.
But in case we introduce some iron regulator like small masses,
well, in any case, you have to introduce this energy scale. Okay. So this is a receipt. And once we have done that, so our receipt is what is a receipt? The renormalization receipt. Receipt. We choose renormalization scale mu. In our case, we have choose a physical mass, which in our case is zero. And adjust the coefficient A, B, C in the action, S of phi, so that the 2-point function and the 4-point function are and you choose a GR are defined as a function of the mass physical equals zero and GR at this renormalization point, Pi, R, R. And then the calculation show that the 2-point function of P, the 4-point function of P are finite when we take the cut of lambda goes to infinity. So it's sufficient to make, to adjust the coefficient so that the four-point function and the two-point function are finite at some particular point to make them finite for all value of the momenta. Okay. So this is a receipt that works of renormalization. And this should correspond to what you have seen in the QFT1 course. Okay, so I just have repeated for this 5-4 theory. Okay. And so, from that point of view, we have constructed a renormalized two-point function. Here, so we can consider that this is just a renormalized two-point function. Okay, which is given by this result. And this is the renormalized four-point function. Okay. So now, what about the other four-point function? What about gamma 6, for instance, of P1 up to P6? Okay. Well, we have seen that at leading order, at classical order, it is zero. There is no phi 6 term in the Hamiltonian. We have seen that gamma 6, which is the irreducible 6-point function, is zero at leading order. And then at first order in H bar, at one loop order, it's proportional to G cube. Well, in our theory, it's proportional to C cube times a sum of diagrams like that, triangle diagrams. Well, there are 15 of them, but basically, okay. And this is a term of order H bar. There are no term of order zero. So at order H bar, you can replace this by H bar G renormalized square plus term of order H bar square. Okay. And is this sufficient to make the theory finite? Yes, because this is, in any case, this is ultraviolet finite, because these diagrams behave like an integral of a four momenta divided by 1 over k to the 6. So this diagram is something like integral d4k times 1 over k to the 6. So at large momenta, it's fine. So it is ultraviolet finite. Okay. So all the irreducible they are ultraviolet finite. So this receipts makes the whole theory ultraviolet finite. Because basically all the diagrams of the quantum effective action are finite. And from the quantum effective action, you can go back to the sum of the connected Green function and all the Green function of the series. They are all finite. Okay, so the Green function of the series are finite. Well, with this receipt at one loop. Okay? Good. So now, before discussing, well, if I have time, I could discuss the massive theory, but that's not the most important. It works out for the massive theory as well. But before that, let me discuss two things. First, I discussed the theory 5-4 in four-dimensional Euclidean spacetime. Then you see that what you need is the renormalization of the mass and phi squared and phi 4 the term in the action between those two operators have to be renormalized. Okay? There is no renormalization of the term d phi squared at one loop. And that's a peculiarity of the 5-4 theory. And in addition, the important point is that there is a logarithmic divergence, so there is a logarithmic counterterms, log lambda counterterms for the 5-4 theory. Well, there is an effect of mass renormalization that has to be there physically for any dimension, but the important term is that the counterterm of phi 4 is a log lambda. So it's just on the verge of being. So in this case, the theory is said to be strictly renormalizable. Okay? Now, let us consider another theory that you have studied in a tutorial, I think, which is the phi cube theory. In the phi cube theory, well, it turns out that, in fact, it's in six dimensions that the theory is divergent. Because there is a phi cube and a phi 4 renormalization. The phi squared and the phi cube. In fact, there is a, well, phi cube theory has a diagram like that. It has a diagram like that, and it has a diagram like that. This is the diagram I draw here. So this diagram in six dimensions diverge like lambda 4. This is a mass diagram. These diagrams diverge like lambda squared. So there is a mass, it's also a mass. But in fact, it's diverged like, if you think about it, it's diverged like lambda squared, because this diagram plus p squared log lambda, because it depends on the momentum. Okay, and this diagram diverges like log of lambda, where p is the momentum that flows. That's in six dimensions. Therefore, there is a phi squared and a phi 4 renormalization, which are analogous to the renormalization of the mass diagram here. There is a phi 6 logarithmic renormalization. But in addition, there is a p squared log lambda renormalization. This means that the operator d phi squared has also a log lambda renormalization. Okay. And in general, this term has to be renormalized. It's just a peculiarity of phi to the 4. So this renormalization is also often called a wave function renormalization. Okay. It's a bit historical because it's rather a field renormalization, but okay. And this means that phi 6 in D equal, I'm sorry, phi cube in D equals 6 is also strictly renormalizable. Okay? So now, what about phi 4 in 6 dimension? So this is 1, 6. Let us consider, well, first let us consider phi 4 in 2 dimension. Then this diagram is convergent. This diagram is divergent, but for instance, in 2 dimensions, this diagram diverged like a log of lambda, and that's it. That's the only diagram, only divergent diagram. Phi 4 in D equal in 3 dimension. These diagrams diverge like a lambda, a single power of lambda. If you work a little bit, you realize that there is a diagram at 2 loop. Remember, I draw some diagram at 2 loop, but I do not compute them. But if you think about them and analyze them, these diagrams like diverge as a log lambda, and that's it. But the only one. Only divergent diagrams. So this means that you do not need to perform a phi 4 renormalization. There is only a phi cube, phi squared renormalization. In both cases, there is only a phi squared renormalization. Okay? So it is said that phi 4 in D less than 4 is super, super renormalizable. You only have to eventually subtract some counter terms, adjust the mass. Okay. And finally, if you go to phi 4 in D equals 6, for instance, then we are in a very bad shape because this triangle diagram is a diagram of phi 6, of phi 4, and it's diverged like a log of lambda. And this diagram diverges now like lambda squared. So it means that if you start from the phi 4 theory in D equals 6, already at 1 loop, you have to add the counter terms proportional to phi 6 theory. And things will blow up. At 2 loop order, you will have to introduce phi to the A, etc. So the theory, phi 4 in dimension larger than 4, is said to be non-renormalizable. Because you cannot just adjust the coefficient of the original action to get a finite theory. You have to add new terms. And in general, no control on this renormalization process, well, unless something happens that I'm not going to discuss at that stage. Okay. So now have half an hour to discuss a very important feature of renormalization theory, which is the fact that in fact the renormalized coupling constant depends on the renormalization scheme. Scale mu. And what it means for the theory. Because as you have seen here, well, I re-expressed the four-point function in my original theory in terms of GR, it depends on GR and on mu explicitly through this explicit calculation. So it seems to depend on two parameters, GR and mu, a dimensionless one and a dimensionful one, mu, instead of the original theory that was depending on only one coupling constant C. So we have a dimensionless coupling, parameter which is GR, and parameter which is mu. Well, what does it mean? Does it mean that we have a trade one problem, you travel a divergent for another one, there is a new parameter in the quantum theory? No. No, because you just have to realize that the original theory depends on one parameter, and we express it in terms of a second parameter, a new parameter GR, that is defined by the value of the four-point function of the original theory at a given scale mu. So it means that if you choose two mu, let us choose, we take a physical theory, renormalized theory. Okay, defined by this process, but with the same C. If you choose a renormalization scale mu, we get some GR. Now, if you choose a mu prime different from mu, we get a GR prime. Yes, because we measure a different quantity. We measure the four-point function at a different value, different point in momentum space. So there is no reason we get the same value for GR. Yes? Pardon?
Do you mean we get from experiment, or yes. Like, sort of say choose GR in some?
Yeah, so this renormalized coupling constant corresponds to some value you measure in an experiment at a given energy scale. So for the same physical theory, if you measure things at different energies, you get different results. Okay. But it will correspond to the same theory if the theory we started from is the same. So in other words, if this relation, the original relation in term, I inverted this relation that I inverted. So in other words, if C is equal to GR plus H bar over 2 GR squared, that was a factor of 3. H bar 3 half log of lambda over mu squared. Well, let us forget about the other terms. Equal GR prime plus H bar 3 half GR prime log of lambda over mu prime squared, then it's the same physical theory. Okay? And so, you can draw the following picture. You can, in appearance, you have a two-parameter scale. So let me write Well, for simplicity, let me write log mu, because in fact it's log mu that is important, and gr. Okay? Well, if I define my theory at a given mu here, let us say mu1, I get some gr1. One. If I have a different coupling here, I have a GR2. You see? Now, if for the same theory I define things at different coupling mu2, well, this is mu and mu prime, so perhaps. Yes. Well, let us write this mu and mu prime. Then I will have here, for the same theory, a different gr1 prime, and here a gr2 prime. And this is a renormalized coupling. Okay. But this G prime 1 and this G prime 2 for renormalized coupling, if they are related by this relation, they describe in fact the same theory. A theory with a coupling 1. While those two are defined by the different theory, theory 2, characterized by a different C. Okay? And so, in fact, in this two-parameter space, in fact, you have lines that correspond to the same theory, in fact, simply expressed in terms of the parameter defined at different energy scale. And so, in fact, there is, if you want, some fragmentation of this space. It is a big mathematical word to say that. And in fact, the theory depends only effectively on one parameter. So you have a one-dimensional space of physical theory, of physical renormalized theories. Okay? And now, well, this relation is a bit ugly because it's, in fact, you have to write the relation between G and G prime as a function of lambda and C and take the limit when lambda goes to infinity and C goes to infinity accordingly so that GR and GR prime are finite. So it's a bit ugly. So it's better to take the lambda goes to infinity limit of this relation and to write how does GR depends on the energy scale mu. And for this, well, I'm going to do the same thing, but in a different way, slightly different way. So now I have my GR coupling, and I assume that at starting reference frame mu naught, its value is gr naught. And I want to understand what's going on when I change mu, or log mu, if you want. Okay? So the best way is to write this in differential form. So I consider the function gr of mu to be the function that obeys to this relation, which is such that gr at scale mu naught is equal to gr naught. So this is a curve. Okay? And I would like to write how does gr of mu depends on the logarithm of mu. It's convenient to consider the logarithm because always logarithms that appears because these are logarithmic divergence. Okay, so you take this equation, and here I replace it with gr naught log of mu naught. You work a little bit, and what you find is 3 over 4 pi squared. Oh, that's because I forgot 1 over. I'm sorry. Oh my god. Nobody noticed that. That's really bad. You didn't sleep much more than me. Here there is a factor 1 over 4 pi. So here there is a factor 4 pi squared. 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 So if you take, basically you take the derivative of this relation. So this, there is a factor 2 that comes out from this, so you get a 3. So what you get is, there will be a factor h bar if you want. Gr squared plus higher order terms. So that's a simple way to re-express this relation. And the coefficient here comes from this coefficient. Okay? Well, by definition, this derivative function is called the beta function. This is the Callan-Simoncic beta function of the theory. In fact, this concept that the coupling constant depends on the energy scale was already discussed and discovered before in the context of quantum electrodynamics by Gell-Mann. But usually, Callan and Simoncic discussed it in a more general context, in particular for phi 4 theory, in application with Wilson theory, etc. So it's called the beta function. And it's called the beta function basically because in some of the first papers, this function was denoted beta. There was some function alpha, beta, gamma. And beta function is a nice word, so it becomes. That's a standard denomination. Okay. And in fact, the real coupling constant that we have seen is not gr, but h bar gr. So in fact, if you express this in terms of h bar gr, you have an h bar squared. So it's the beta function is really without h bar. So if I set h bar equal 1, that's OK. And then it means that you have term of order gr to the cube. Okay. So rather than writing things in terms of the bare theory with a cutoff, better renormalize the theory. And once you have renormalized the theory, you use those renormalized four-point functions, and you see how gr must change with mu when you change mu in order to still have the same physics. Okay? And so what does this, what this means? This means that in fact, as we have seen already, the coupling constant, the renormalized coupling, the coupling to measure depends on the renormalization scale. And its dependence in the scale is given by the solution of this equation. This is the simplest case, what is called the renormalization group flow equation. So this is a renormalization group flow equation. Here, in the space of couplings of the series. And here the space of the coupling of the series is just one dimensional, but we have a flow on the line. Okay? And the fact that, so the important fact is that the beta function has the form a positive constant, 3 over 4 pi squared, in our case, gr squared, with a positive coefficient. This is a function that behaves like that. Beta of g as a function of the renormalized coupling. Okay? So, what does this mean? It means that the higher the energy when log lambda increases, GR increases. Okay? It means that on the line of renormalized coupling, this is zero and somewhere is far away is infinite. If you start at some scale mu zero by a theory defined at the coupling constant, if you measure your phenomena and measure your coupling constant at higher energy, GR goes. So we have what is called an ultraviolet flow. Mu goes to infinity. And you have an infrared flow that goes to zero when mu goes to zero. See? So it means that at high energy, energies, the theory is strongly coupled. And at small energy, the theory is weakly coupled. Okay? And you can solve this equation and see what's going on. And you discover that there are some problems, but I'm not going to discuss that. I'm going to discuss, let me discuss that in this framework, the fact that the beta function, the fact that there is a renormalization of the coupling constant and the fact that the beta function is not zero, which is a consequence of the fact that there are log lambda terms in the expansion and you have to, the theory is renormalized. The fact that the beta function of G is different from zero, in fact, reflects a very important property of phi 4 theory. It reflects that the fact that the scale invariance of the classical theory is anomalous. Namely, it is broken by quantum effects. Okay? So what does this mean? Let us go back to the classical theory. classical massless, that's very important, phi 4. Action is just 1 half d phi squared d 4x plus g, well, normalized by phi to the 4. So this theory has a remarkable property. It is scale invariant. This means that this is the action of a given configuration. If you change phi of x into phi lambda of x, well, that's not the same lambda. It's not a cutoff. It's just a factor, scale lambda, which is defined as lambda to the power phi of lambda x. So I just make a scale transformation. So this is a scale transformation. I take any field configuration and dilate the lambda, the x's, the position, and rescale the phi accordingly to this rescaling. Then it's a trivial calculation to show that S of phi lambda equals S of phi, which means that the theory has a scale invariance. Okay. In fact, it has even classical conformal invariance in the sense that if I change x, so scale invariance is changing x into lambda x, and conformal invariance is changing x into 1 over x. And with proper boundary condition at infinity, the theory is still invariant, which is quite remarkable. Okay. But, so we have a theory. So we have a classical scale invariant. So we have a current to any symmetry. We have a Noether current. Noether current. Okay. And if you work a little bit, you'd show that you discover, if I am not mistaken, that this Noether current, so this is a symmetry by a single factor. So there is just one current. And this is basically the stress energy tensor times x nu plus phi d mu phi. Okay? This is the Noether current. And this current is conserved. T mu nu is just what is called the energy momentum tensor. And so, and that's the current associated for translations. So out of the currents for the symmetry under translation, you can build the current associated to scale transformation, where you have these terms and these terms that correspond to this and this. Okay? And well, as you would expect, classically, you found that d mu g mu is zero. Okay? It is conserved, classically. So this is in four dimensions. Now, it turns out that if you quantize your theory and work out, so the current, and work out what is this when G is transformed into a quantum current, so it's an operator, you find that, so that's for the classical theory. For the quantum theory, well, you do the calculation and you find that d mu g mu is not equal to zero. There is a quantum correction, and if I want to write this quantum correction, let us keep the h bar to state that I have some h bar here. You find this is h bar, the beta function for the coupling constant times phi 4 divided by factorial 4. And this is something that has, this operator has a dimension, the correct dimension. It has the same dimension, the same quantum number as the mu g. Okay? And one nice way to see this is to use dimensional regularization. Okay? Because if you are in d equal 4, in d different from 4, you can associate a neutral current to the scale transformation, but the theory is not scale invariant anymore. Which means that d mu g mu is different from zero. And you do the calculation, you find that it is d minus 4, the coupling constant divided by factorial 4 times the operator phi 4 4. Okay? That's a classical calculation. Classical calculation. Using the equation of motion. Of the classical theory. So, that's perfect. When d goes to 4, d mu g mu equals 0. Except, but the quantum theory has ultraviolet divergences. You see? So g has to be renormalized by term of order some g squared log lambda with some coefficient. In dimensional regularization, remember the rule that I've not explained is that log lambda corresponds to poles. So basically, g has to be changed by g to g squared 1 over d minus 4. And when d goes to 4, so this is a renormalized coupling constant. And when d goes to 4, these poles cancel this one. Okay, so that's one short but unwaving but short way to derive, to explain why there is a scale anomaly. Okay, so basically, the theory has a scale anomaly. And there is a symmetry, classical symmetry that cannot be enforced in the quantum theory. The quantum effect spoils this symmetry. Okay. And that's the reason why the effective coupling constant, the physical coupling constant, depends on the energy. That's because if in the classical theory they are independent of the energy, they are a pure number. But that's because of the scale anomaly that you have these effects of what's called running coupling constant. Okay. And this is the first example of a phenomenon that you call anomaly. I don't know if you have discussed at all. In fact, anomaly are a very important feature. Of quantum theory. So you are going to see, I think, in some advanced high energy course or particle physics course that, for instance, QED with massless electrons fermions, let us say, massless fermions, as a symmetry that is called the axial symmetry. That is broken by quantum effects. I'm right. Yes. Okay. And that's a crucial feature that explains many things in the physics of pions and mesons. Okay. And when you are going to do QCD, string theories, etc., anomalies will pop out everywhere, and in some cases they just reflect the fact that some symmetry are not present in the quantum theory, and sometimes they are worse than that. They say that if you try to build a theory that has some kind of present gauge anomaly, in general it means that the theory cannot be renormalized and it doesn't exist. So the existence of anomaly makes stringent constraint on the kind of quantum theory you can construct. So the scale anomaly is one of the simplest examples of anomaly. Also, the first example of was the axial anomaly that was discovered, I think, at the beginning of the 60s by Adler and Jakiv, and by it was discovered by Steve Adler and by Jakiv and Bell. And this Bell is the John Bell of the Bell's inequality, by the way. Okay. Okay, thank you.